Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. This case involves a series of attacks on the integrity of the legal system and on the integrity of individuals within the legal system, particularly two associate circuit court judges, a represented criminal party, and the advisory committee. And with all due respect to the disciplinary hearing panel, which heard this case, closing our eyes and tolerating respondents' prejudicial misconduct serves to undermine the public's faith in the integrity of our legal system. There were 8 instances of prejudicial misconduct pled in 4 counts. I'd like to briefly talk about each. The first 2 involve false and reckless statements made about Associate Circuit Court Judge Joe Satterfield, who had to cancel a court date to come to the respondent's hearing and defend himself. The respondent posted on the internet an accusation that Judge Satterfield was engaged in a conspiracy with the prosecuting attorney and others, where he tripled the bond on an individual to prevent her, to force her to testify for the prosecution in a particular case, a case she wasn't even involved in, a case where she just interpreted it from talking to the various defendants and witnesses involved. At the disciplinary hearing, the respondent never produced any evidence that Judge Satterfield was engaged in any kind of misconduct. In her brief, she talks about it being her interpretation of the facts, but she concedes that the judge could have seen it another way. And Judge Satterfield, of course, testified that he was not engaged in any prejudicial misconduct and that he used his discretion in setting the bonds in 2 particular charged matters. And there was no cross-examination that he did anything that was inappropriate.
The DHP did find that inappropriate, and that's the basis on which they recommended a reprimand.
They found it inappropriate, but I think they failed to realize the seriousness, the impact on the integrity of the legal system. When a lawyer in an internet forum states that I am a former prosecutor, I am a lawyer, therefore adding weight to what she is saying, and to defame a circuit court judge in a matter that she's not even involved in, based on her own delusion, her own interpretation.
The respondent says that she has some First Amendment rights in this area. What is your response to that?
I think that this is a case about conduct. I think that a reasonable attorney who believes that Judge Satterfield committed some sort of constitutional violation would have reported Judge Satterfield to the Judicial Commission. She wouldn't have posted on a public internet forum accusations that, again, are her interpretations. She admits that in her brief. There are no facts that she presented at the hearing to show that the reason the judge gave a higher bond amount after a second charge was filed was because he was trying to force this particular defendant to testify against a co-defendant. That's just her interpretation of it, but she states it like a fact, and she reminds everyone in the internet posting that she's an attorney and former prosecutor. And under Rule 8.3, she has a duty that if she knows a judge has committed a violation of the rules of professional conduct that raise a substantial question as to the judge's fitness.
There was, in the Buzz Westfall case, Buzz disciplined for saying that the judge was not, the decision was not intellectually honest?
Yes, I think the important part that the Chief Disciplinary Counsel sees in this matter is it's in addition to what was said, it's the conduct that the lawyer engaged in this particular matter. That this, she states it as a fact. She says, I have proof that Judge Satterfield did this with the bond to prevent this witness from testifying. She said she had proof. There was no proof. There was no anything, no evidence presented.
Is the judge a public figure?
The judge is a public figure. However, that doesn't excuse a lawyer from acting responsibly and acting as an officer of the court with respect to what she is going to say and in the form she's choosing
to
say.
Is it an issue of truth? I mean, if in fact she did have, which of course there was no proof here, but say we had a situation where someone made an allegation and they did have specific proof which they came forward with. I mean, how do we distinguish what's a First Amendment right from what's a does it depend on truth or calling something an illegality where it wasn't illegal or what is fair criticism, and especially as a public figure, you should be able to handle that versus what steps over the line or becomes conduct.
Absolutely, and there's always room for fair criticism. I think that the appropriate forum is really the key here, that under the rules she's required to report the judge to the authorities.
But does that mean she has no right to say anything so nobody can grumble when they go back to the office about the ruling they just got?
I understand the way you're parsing this. When she comes,
I'm really seeking guidance on what you think is okay and not, because there has to be an ability to complain about a ruling, and yet there has to be a line too.
Again, I think that if she's going to say this is true, she has to come forward with evidence. She's failed to come forward with evidence that proves or even implies that Judge Satterfield committed a constitutional violation here, as she's alleged in the internet forum. So it's the strength in which she said it. It's the conviction in which she said it. It's the fact that the judge had to come and say, I'm not guilty of any misconduct. I understand it's a fine line.
She drew on her reputation as a prosecutor and to suggest she had private knowledge, which
absolutely,
in fact she was not
absolutely
able,
and she was not involved in the case at all. In fact, she was representing her boyfriend on the same charges, which brings up what I think is the most egregious attack on the integrity of the legal system. She went into the local county jail and engaged in a conversation with this particular criminal defendant. Her name was Jessica Billings. Jessica was represented by a separate defendant for the same charge that the respondent's client, the boyfriend of the girl, was charged, a felony gun possession matter. She engages in a conversation. She's asked questions about what's going to happen to my kids, because the department has taken my kids. And then she asks, how is this going to affect my case? Should I testify against my boyfriend in this case? She starts to ask questions about the representation of the particular case, knowing that Ms. Billings is represented by Sean Boyd, a separate attorney. She's actually engaging in a conversation with a criminal party who asks her, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to my kids? What's going to happen to me if I choose to testify against my boyfriend? And her response is, instead of saying, you have an attorney, it's inappropriate for me to speak with you, you need to go talk to your attorney, she says, I'm going to eat you up in court. She actually says something intimidating to this particular witness, and she doesn't recognize that that is wrong. In her brief, she says, this isn't wrong for me to be talking to a represented party because the represented party asked me a question and was talking to me. She fails to recognize the seriousness of what she did. And think about the potential harm here. When a witness who's worried about her kids, who's worried about herself in jail, asks the attorney for someone that either could testify against one another and gets a response that I'm going to be attacked on cross-examination, that's intimidating. The potential for prejudice is unbelievable here.
It's often been said, you have the freedom of speech, but you don't always have to exercise it, especially in the kind of manner that you're describing. But if you're talking about a public official like you were the judge, I was accused of, I'm Jewish, I was accused of killing Jesus. I mean, I didn't. And so, what am I supposed to say? I mean, is that person guilty? I was a judge. The person said I killed Jesus. What am I supposed to do? I mean, is that person subject to discipline?
If it's an attorney who's saying this, I think we look at what a reasonable attorney would do. That's what this court said in the Madison case. Would a reasonable attorney go on the internet where thousands of people can read a posting and say, I have proof that a judge committed a crime?
Well, the comments were about how the judge carried out the duties of his office and suggesting the judge did so without integrity, it wasn't simply an ad hominem attack, say, on someone's religion or whatever.
That's correct. It goes to the process. It goes to the legal system. It goes to the integrity of
the system.
Well,
then another one was I had a target on me and a line through it and said I had ruled against gun control or something, and that was never the case. And that was on the internet, and that was it depended whether a lawyer did it or a non-lawyer, but I'm a public official. So
I think there is a distinction, Your Honor, when we're talking about an attorney who the public, that's the only connection that the public has, the main connection that the public has to the system, is what we as officers of the court say and do.
Can you address the alleged misrepresentations that respondent made to the advisory committee about her health and waiver of the
expertise? Absolutely. Absolutely. There are letters that go into excruciating detail about the respondent's alleged physical condition to basically not be able to engage in any kind of work at all. She can't type, she can't walk, she can't lift, she can't bend, she's in constant pain. She tried to return to work, but she represented to the advisory committee that she is unable to work right now. She's applied for disability, she's applied for welfare. It turns out, however, that she's actively engaged in the practice of law, and I've set out in my brief months and months of all of the different cases in Southeast Missouri. She made a representation that she was unable to practice law, yet it wasn't true.
Are there any medical records to support her claims
in this record? That's an excellent point, Your Honor. There has never been a presentation of any medical records at the disciplinary hearing or through any of these motions to continue that were before the disciplinary hearing committee or before the court that substantiate any kind of physical incapacity to practice law. And again, the fact that she was actively practicing law, showing up to court, filing pleadings, appearing at her disciplinary hearing for 8 hours and attempting to defend herself shows that she has the capacity to practice law.
So by asking for a waiver for dues, she's lying to a tribunal, which would bring her under the canons of ethics.
Absolutely, and that makes it worse, in our opinion. There are very few reasons that a lawyer doesn't have to pay their bar dues. Either they're retired judges or they've been in practice for 50 years, but there is no, there's nothing in the rule that says that because of a partial disability or because of other reasons that a lawyer doesn't have to pay.
Opposing counsel, and apparently the DHP, said an incapacity to practice law can mean that you're not going to make much money. You're not going to be able to practice it full-time or at the pace you would prefer, at the pace you used to. And therefore, they found that was not a misrepresentation.
I think the standard with respect to whether a lawyer has capacity to practice law, we have a definition of practice of law in 484.020, I believe, maybe it's 010, that filing pleadings and standing before the court is the practice of law. There are other provisions in the law for partial incapacity under Rule 5.23 that actually parse out disability, partial incapacity.
Well, that's a finding. I mean, we often will get requests that they're back dues, they haven't paid dues for 3 or 4 or 10 years because they had a baby or they had a child or they couldn't afford to practice law or they chose not to practice law. Now they want a waiver of those fees or that they were incapacitated and they and maybe still incapacitated and they couldn't afford to pay the dues. They asked for a waiver of the Supreme Court on those grounds. But we don't necessarily say you can't practice. We just are dealing with the issue of the fees, not the
right. Well,
not their ability to practice or not.
Right. The way the rule has been interpreted is if you have the capacity to practice law in any capacity, the ability to practice law in any capacity, earning fees or making a living is immaterial. There's a lot of attorneys that only do pro bono work and make their money in the business world. They still have to pay their dues. If you can practice law, you have to pay your dues.
You all are recommending a suspension, but the DHP recommended a reprimand.
Exactly. We respectfully disagree. Her actions, the way she's carried out what she said and what she's done, is so over the top. And I don't think this court can ignore the motion for an interim suspension that is before it to recognize that she lacks the fitness right now to practice law. She probably needs to be sidelined for a while in order to get some counseling, in order to perhaps have an evaluation to find out why she continues to engage in the activities in the misconduct.
Is your motion for the immediate suspension based on psychological or physical?
I think that it's been pled in the alternative. Again, if we had medical records in any of this, we would know for certain whether there was something that's...
Well, wouldn't that be your burden to obtain the medical records if you're seeking to dislodge her from practice because of... physical or mental disability?
She's the one that has said, although never brought before the court, that she couldn't show up to trial because of her incapacity. So in the trial court, I believe, is still waiting at this time before ruling on the contempt motion before it as to what if any medical issues she has. So in going forward and in pursuing the interim suspension, the records would be something.
Attempted discovery on that issue.
Pardon me?
Has there been attempted discovery?
Not medical condition
and medical record.
Not to my knowledge.
So to the extent the record indicates that it's a reliance upon her statements or admissions as to what her health conditions have been.
Absolutely.
And what you're saying is she said she couldn't do it in one place, but she was doing it in another.
Exactly. And she does it at her own discretion, for her own reasons, choosing to show up, not to show up, making those decisions. She's unreliable and she's prejudicing the integrity of the legal system and trials and the course of justice in those counties. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and thank you for allowing me to address you. And let me state that Lisa Coatney is not a well woman, and let me try and characterize her a little bit so you can get a picture of what she looks like. She's not an unattractive woman. She somewhat looks like Sarah Palin. Not an attractive Sarah Palin, but she's of that build, of that shape, of those facial features.
Well, Mr. Allen, can you address the point that was just asked of your adversary? Whose burden is it here to bring in medical records to show what you're about to describe as her incapacity? I mean, is that your burden? Or is it the burden of the informant who's seeking to have her disciplined, with one of the grounds being that she made a false claim?
Under that circumstance, I believe the burden of proof would have been on the prosecution to say, produce your medical records and we'll see how incapacitated you are.
Why can't they rely upon your client's statements, where she said for years that she's unable to practice and doesn't need and can't pay her bar dues in?
I think they could. And I think when she presents herself before a body, if she was here, you'd see that she was having she's not a strong woman.
Well, aren't you kind of in a box one way or the other? What she has said is true and she can't practice and we would have to remove her from practice, or it's a lie?
Well, it's not a lie. It's a good question as to whether or not she should be practicing, even if she's not charging fees to her clients, which is why she doesn't charge fees, is because she tells them, I will do what I can for you as a lawyer.
Legal aid attorneys don't charge fees, but they're bound by the rules of conduct and veracity.
That's correct. But Lisa Coatney is a strong advocate. She is, if nothing else, she is the embodiment of what we say is a zealous advocate for the court.
But
she chooses to practice in the way she does because of her incapacities and disabilities.
Counsel, she didn't say, I want to do just a pro bono practice. Can I have a discounted rate for my fees because I'm not going to have much money to pay them? She said, I have an incapacity to practice. She spent paragraphs and paragraphs explaining all these medical conditions, and that's the basis on which she said she couldn't appear, and yet she appeared. And I know you all disagree as to how many different clients and how many different appearances, but more than 100 appearances in court for some 40 or 50 clients. That's called practicing law, and in most anybody's book, whether or not she charged. I mean, you can't make one representation and yet act differently.
I would agree with that, but I would say that she's not, I don't think she's out there to lie to the Bar Committee or the Bar Association and say she can't, she's not she doesn't make any money.
What if we don't put people upon poor people because they don't make any money? We don't allow malpractice upon poor people because we're not charging a fee. The problem is, if she's incapacitated and she's made statements to that effect officially in trying to get the dues waivers, she's on record as saying she's incapacitated, which might be enough evidence to go forward with the interim suspension. In her own words, a statement against interest.
Well, the interim suspension, let me address that the suspension aspect of it in this way is that a little bit, other than this part two of this discipline, Lisa was disciplined, and she was reprimanded. Initially, the recommendation was for an admonishment, but that wasn't accepted by the OCDC, so the full hearing went forward, and then the reprimand came down, and only on one count. They accepted this issue with the fees that she was there, that she couldn't practice law, whether or not she's stating that later on when she does, in fact, go out and represent people, charge or not. At the time that she was asking for the waiver, she was stating a truth. I can't.
Not the third year. She'd been taking cases, and she continued to take cases.
She did.
The first year, maybe the second.
Well,
the third, that clearly was contrary to fact.
That gets to the point, then, of the disciplinary thing, is how to handle this thing. Do you say, we're not going to give you a waiver anymore, or pay back the past fees, or whatever? And what I'm saying about discipline here is the discipline that we as lawyers get when we get a discipline from the bar is far-reaching, especially now. There's the internet, there's CaseNet, there's AVO. This is a crippling, sometimes crippling, statement of what we're trying to correct. And my position is our disciplinary committee here to help lawyers in peril, or help us keep our practice, or is it to take licenses away?
No, it's to protect the public.
It's to protect the public. Okay.
And addressing, these are all related in the sense that she misrepresented what she was doing in her and that she was not practicing to the advisory committee. And then in her call to Mr. Swingle, she accused a judge of illegalities and in published blogs of illegalities. Seems not to understand the importance of integrity and truthfulness to the judicial process, and that is a danger to her clients and to the integrity of the process and to the respect for the process, which is required if you suggest that a judge is deciding upon non-case-related factors. And First Amendment does not allow you to impugn the integrity of a court or to charge people with illegalities when without in a forum where it's not appropriate or without evidence. But it's the continual lack of respect for the duties of an officer of the court in making statements to authorities.
My address on that would be how this came about. And you raised the issue, the first one, on the First Amendment. These charges, most of them, and the serious ones, came about for an incident, incident in May of 2009, where she's involved with a client, Jermaine Young, who's got a girlfriend, and a whole series of things took place. The comments in the public forum took place about a year and a half later, November of 2010. Now, when we're talking about how and what she said, putting it in terms of what the reasonable attorney would do under the ordinary circumstances, I don't think that was an appropriate thing to say or do, and she was reprimanded. And I want you to understand what I'm here to say is she's gotten her discipline.
How has she been disciplined for asking this court to waive her fees because she could not practice, which is what she said, and yet she was practicing? How so far has she been disciplined for that? I'm not talking about things she said that we don't have any knowledge of. I'm talking about stuff that was filed with this court, which is directly contradictory to her pleadings and appearances in other places. How has she been disciplined for that?
She has not been disciplined for that. And my statement and my argument for her is that the context of when she made the statements and how she might have been thinking in terms of she's probably thinking in terms of, I don't make any money practicing law because I'm sick.
But if she may be
But that's not what she said. What she said was, I am not practicing law.
She did say that. And so, but I don't think she put it into context when she's applying for her waivers of lying.
But she said she couldn't because she was too ill to do it, so she did.
She went out and did things that she at one time before said, yes, I couldn't do. Yes, that's...
Well, before and after. So what you're suggesting is we should only consider whether she was telling the truth on the day she said it, and we shouldn't assume any of her prior activities or statements, and we shouldn't assume any of her following activities or statements when we decide whether or not she was telling us the truth on that day, even though, of course, several days would have passed before we were required to rule on that.
You're going to have to judge that. That's what the tribunal is for. My argument to you is I don't think the context of when she made the representations to the bar and how she conducts her life were put together in her mind as to this is what I'm going to do to get out of my bar dues, but I'm going to go out and practice law. I think she practiced law because people came up and asked. She may not even be thinking I'm practicing law because I'm not charging.
Alone, her representations alone, regardless of punishment or not punishment, if she makes representations of many people who've done nothing wrong in the canons, who might have a mental disability or who are suspended because they're a danger to the public. So whether or not, if she makes statements saying, I am disabled, and I can't do that, the OCDC can take those statements and use them to do an interim suspension, put them on probation, investigate further. Regardless of anything they might have said about a judge or anyone else, just basically on the fact that they made those statements.
Well, that's what we're asking, that the OCD not be allowed to do that, because the OCD is just a prosecuting body as far as...
Well, why can't they rely on her statements?
They haven't relied on her statements.
She said she's incapable of practicing law.
She admits it. I'm sorry. That's
don't we then take her at face value and say, very well, you're interim suspended?
But my point is there's a method of doing this is to let's take you through the disciplinary process or... Lisa, you can't practice law. How can we work this out? Let's get this. Don't you take some time off? Get healed. Do something else. Do appeals.
But that's what the OCDC is for with probation. As Judge Russell said so well, it's about protecting the public.
Let
me ask a question in the context of your comment. As somebody who has to review these applications for waiver, are you suggesting that what I need to do is not take lawyers at their word and run my own case net and decide whether or not they're lying to me right then, whether I grant or not grant their waiver for fees?
No, the system would never work that way. It's too cumbersome. You have to have the
trust. So isn't there some value, and don't our rules assume that when lawyers make statements to us that they're telling us the truth,
yes,
especially as it relates to their own conduct? We're not talking about the conduct of some client or representations based on anything other than what's in their own mind.
I can't argue with that, sir. That's especially as lawyers. We're representing ourselves to particular bodies, and that should be at that high standard that we're held to.
Let me ask you this in a practical situation. We have this pending motion for discipline in front of us. We have another motion that your client be suspended prior to hearing from the practice of law, or in the alternative, to initiate hearings to suspend your client for physical or mental reasons. How do you think the fairest, most practical way to proceed?
I think
what should we do?
Hear her out. The immediacy of the temporary suspension, I don't think it's necessary. She's not harming the public immediately, daily, or irreparably.
Is she practicing at this time?
No, she's in the hospital at this time for the very reasons that this series of events have been.
She's in the hospital for how long, and how long will this, when will she re-engage in practice?
It's my understanding she'll be out in 10 days or the September, actually 2 days. She's been in the hospital. When I filed the motion, I asked for a little bit of a continuance. That was the first, I believe, of September. She said she'd be hospitalized till 10 days. I don't particularly understand her condition, but it involves those drips that antibiotic drips and hospitalization.
But counsel, and there was a case below where she was representing someone. I don't know if it was for fee or not, and she was not able to come because of her health. But the case was not continued. She didn't respond. Didn't get faxes. The jurors had to be summoned and then sent away. Those are the kind of harms that we need to be concerned about, and that raise the issue about whether she can practice. And I take her to the reasons that OCDC has asked for an interim suspension, because they're concerned she may take on cases that her health, even though she intending to do them and to represent people who she thinks need her help, but she doesn't seem capable of discerning what cases she can in fact handle competently, because she's not able to predict when this will hit her and doesn't seem to have backup when she does get these medical conditions. And doesn't that put the public at risk, those clients at risk, when that happens?
She's not
able to make for herself to figure out a way to make sure they're protected if her health takes a turn for the worse as it has now.
Well, this is my argument here is that the term discipline in my mind is harsh. The term of lawyers in peril, alcoholic lawyers, drug abusing lawyers, mentally incapacitated lawyers, they shouldn't be disciplined. They should be certainly taken, maybe have their license suspended, not in a disciplinary way, but
we
in
have suspensions for health reasons that are.
You know, personally, I've talked to Lisa about this. I think she's should say you got to take some time off here. Yep. You can't go in and out of this stuff. And what's the point if you're not charging anybody anything?
Well, and you say that when she gets out of the hospital that she will not practice law, and your definition of practice law may mean that she's not charging clients. Regardless of that, how can we be assured that the public will be protected from her when she gets out of the hospital, that she will not be engaging in legal services for people that don't pay?
I would, to answer your question, I would say a condition of suspension or a condition of some sort of, we're going to force you to do what we want you to do, which is by your own admission, what you can't do is we want you to get some help, and we don't want you to be putting your clients in jeopardy with trials that you can't make. You can't do this job, Lisa, and she has to be convinced of that. But I don't think it's out of perniciousness or falsity or whatever that her conduct that's being brought
but
here.
But interim suspension could be someone's got dementia, someone's, there's no, true, the word suspension has some kind of, maybe a pejorative, but the OCDC has on probation, they have medical professionals, they have oversight, they have people that monitor, people that have shown that they are a risk to the public. The idea is not to be a punishment, but to be a way of monitoring so that someone is not a danger to the public.
I fully would accept that. We haven't done that. Nobody's come to me and said, how's a better way to work this out? And I would bring Lisa in for that effort.
So you think some type of suspension would be appropriate with conditions that she not be allowed to practice until she shows sufficient proof that she's able to do it?
Well, I think because I can't advocate any better of that, but I see what you people see, and I think Lisa sees that maybe in a different context, but I think she does need some help. And my point is that we've got the professional code of conduct has an all or nothing deal. I don't see much in there of a wide array of remedies other than we're going to discipline you or we're going to bring about some sort of result that is to protect the public, but also to, and it's, I don't think it's solely to protect the public. I think it's to give our lawyers deal of we want to help your conduct. We want to make this bar stronger and better.
And you would request, in response to the request for interim suspension, that there be a hearing at which these kinds of issues can be discussed.
I think that'd be fair to her, and I think that it might set a precedent for the legal assistance bar, that there is a way to tell lawyers you're not risking your license if you've got a medical, mental, physical health problem. We don't have to fight the battle. Let's get into some remediation for you that's for your good and gets you out of risk with your clients, your public, your partners, whatever it is. That's not in the, it's not available right now, or it's not being used. That's my argument.
Well, isn't that though the nature of the motion that the disciplinary counsel filed on the medical suspension, that the court either ought to suspend her and then you request a hearing when you're ready, or hold a hearing and see if she should be suspended?
The interim suspension was just brought up. I was kind of arguing here today on whether or not the reprimand should be stayed in place.
We've got the reprimand. That's one issue. But there's also the issue of what we do right now. And I guess I'm asking you, do you think it would be more appropriate for your client to be suspended and then have a hearing when she's ready to have the hearing, or to have the hearing now pending the suspension? And it would be an emergency, immediate hearing, full-blown medical issues being litigated.
Well, she'd need to present medical evidence one way or the other.
My request would be not to suspend. She's not going to be practicing law in the next 30 days that we couldn't get some.
Well, but what assurance do we have of that? How do we know?
Well, I'd like to tell you that, but I guess my point is, or the other thing is that the law doesn't move like electric light switches going on and off. She's not going to have a raft of clients that are going to be in jeopardy in the next 30 days. I'd like to have.
Mr. Allen, I know your reputation, I know you for many years. I know your representations are true and honest. So nothing you say is what we would do is no aspersion on what you've held forth, because you're a fine lawyer and you've come forward to represent her. Well, I know it would be difficult to get a lawyer, and I appreciate you doing that.
But thank you.
We have to go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, what about this hearing? Go ahead. What about this if there's an interim suspension, they have a right to a hearing post the suspension or before the suspension?
Your Honor, what we're here to ask for today, based on her prior conduct, to the conduct that's led
her representations.
Right, but based on the misrepresentations, based on her danger.
Her representations is she's disabled. I'm not talking about the discipline. I'm talking about how we protect the public. Let's say you're asking for an interim suspension. What's the procedure for
the way to proceed is to suspend her right now, because she's shown that she's a danger to the public. And then, if she can come forward and show that she has rehabilitated. Pardon me?
So procedure for a hearing after the immediate interim suspension, is that correct?
I believe she should be suspended. And at that point, I think she needs the burden shift. She needs to come forward to show that she's capable of practicing law.
But the procedure allows for that.
The procedure allows for that.
I think opposing counsel is saying that she would be willing to enter into an agreement not to practice until a hearing were held if a suspension were delayed until after a hearing, if I'm understanding.
The court can recommend any kind of sanction.
I'm not talking about that. I mean, is that we're really asking from your, and this may not be your issue, but is there a flexibility of procedures for you to work out with them? Is there do you have to be suspended before the hearing, or can there be a hearing first and then the court would look and decide whether or not there's an interim suspension? Concern about whether or not the public would be protected if there were practice prior to the hearing, and is there a way to address that short of suspension?
I don't think so. I think that she hasn't yet shown she's trustworthy or fit in any of these instances to trust the representation that she's not going to practice law. She's got an active practice of law. She's got lawyers right now clients right now that are relying on her. I think the appropriate procedure is to suspend her, because she is a current and present danger to the system.
What's your basis for saying that she has clients right now that are relying on her?
Based on the evidence we've collected from the court record, she's an active attorney in active cases that are before the
court. There are cases where she's not sought to withdraw.
I'm sorry.
There are current pending cases where she has not sought to withdraw.
That's correct. That's correct.
What you're asking for, and I sense that there are two things. You're arguing to us she should be suspended as discipline for past conduct. not that she should have an interim suspension for her inability to practice because of health issues.
Well, that's correct. Actually, you have both, right? We have two pending matters. We have the past, which you've not agreed to the reprimand, and then we have your current motion based upon continued activities and additional information.
That's correct. The way I see it in coming before the court is the current motion for an interim suspension is an aggravating condition to the current set of misrepresentations and misconduct that she's been involved in. Just like not owning up to what she did was wrong is an aggravating factor, and just like most.
Well, we could hold the punitive actions in abeyance while we deal with the interim suspension and find out, or at least the disciplinary people can find out, whether her actions were a result of her mental disability as alleged or incapacity, as opposed to independent of that. If her infractions were caused by some mental incapacity, well, that we have procedures for that, but at least she won't be hurting the public.
You certainly have the leeway to address it that way. The Chief Disciplinary Counsel believes that she currently presents a clear danger to the public, a clear danger to the clients, to the judges that are in the legal system. She's already demonstrated she's not fit to practice law. She should be sidelined until she can prove she's fit. If this court sees a different procedure because of the pending of the motion for an interim suspension, that's certainly within the discretion of the court.
But if we issued an order of an interim suspension upon 10 days' notice, she's entitled to an expeditious hearing under the rules, true?
Yes, absolutely.
So that's
and you can withhold your ruling in this particular case, I suppose. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you.